You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our first of two podcasts on non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, hosted by Med Learning Group. This series is designed for community-based medical oncologists, hematologists, pharmacists, and other members of the multidisciplinary oncology care team. In this episode, we'll be giving a brief overview of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, or NHL, discussing disease prevalence and prognostication, and talking about initial management strategies of refractory relapse disease. My name is Vaidehi, and I will be the host of today's podcast. Joining me today is Dr. P. Connor Johnson. Dr. Johnson is the attending oncologist at the Center for Lymphoma, Massachusetts General Hospital, and instructor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School located in Boston, Massachusetts. His research focuses on addressing the supportive care needs and mitigating the therapy toxicity of patients with lymphoma, patients receiving cellular therapy, and lymphoma survivors. He conducts studies and clinical trials of interventions to improve patient quality of life and therapy tolerability. Dr. Johnson, thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you, Vi. I'm delighted to be here today and looking forward to the podcast.
Let's start with some background on NHL. Can you tell us about the different types of NHL and what is the disease burden? Maybe walk us through some of the symptoms of NHL.
Absolutely. NHL is a disease with many different subtypes. There's actually more than 80 different subtypes in the most recent WHO classification. To try and drill that down or make that easier, we tend to classify these by indolent or aggressive subtypes. The most common aggressive subtype is diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, accounting for nearly a third of all cases. And the most common indolent lymphoma is follicular lymphoma, accounting for a quarter of all cases. In total, there's 80,000 cases of non-Hodgkin lymphoma per year in the United States, and just over half of those are accounted for by DLBCL and follicular lymphoma. I think a third subtype that's important to know about and that we'll discuss in greater detail today is mantle cell lymphoma, which accounts for about 5 to 6% of all cases. Each of these subtypes of lymphoma have their own distinct presentations. Just to illustrate that, DLBCL, being an aggressive lymphoma, tends to present as advanced stage disease, by which we mean disease above and below the diaphragm or involving organs in one other site. And elevated lactate dehydrogenase and extranodal involvement are common. The most common presentation overall is probably an enlarging lymph node with or without B symptoms, by which we mean fevers and night sweats, weight loss. Follicular lymphoma, in contrast, being an indolent non-Hodgkin lymphoma, often presents asymptomatically or incidentally detected on imaging studies. It's just like DLBCL is a disease of older adults in the sixth decade of life, but it tends to not have extranodal involvement when it presents, and advanced stage disease is very, very common. Mantle cell lymphoma is a unique disease. It actually has a significant male predominance for reasons not fully understood. Almost all patients present with advanced stage disease, and extranodal involvement, particularly of the gastrointestinal tract, is very common. So I think these illustrate that each distinct subtype often has a characteristic presentation.
So is there some way to predict a patient's chances of survival?
That's a fantastic question. We actually have multiple different instruments to assess NHL prognosis based on subtype. For DLBCL, which is the most common subtype, as we've discussed, there are a number of different tools to assess prognosis, such as the International Prognostic Index, or IPI. There's various iterations of these indices. One recent one is the NCCN IPI, and this uses factors such as patient age, lactate dehydrogenase, stage, ECOG performance status, and the presence or absence of extranodal sites to generate a score that can risk stratify patients for their likelihood of durable survival from low to high risk. In respect to follicular lymphoma, there's multiple indices. The most commonly used are the FLIPI or FLIPI2. FLIPI2 specifically incorporates baseline beta-2 microglobulin, the diameter of the largest involved node, bone marrow involvement, hemoglobin, and age. And for mantle cell, we have the MIPI, which uses age, ECOG performance status, LDH, and white blood cell count. So each of these subtypes has a prognostic tool that can risk stratify patients in respect to their likelihood of durable survival.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about DLBCL. what are some of the treatments that are available to patients currently?
That's a terrific question and really a very important question, given that DLBCL is the most common non-Hodgkin lymphoma overall. We've actually seen an explosion of different therapies available for DLBCL over the preceding 3 to 5 years. In the frontline setting, we still typically use R-CHOP, which is chemoimmunotherapy, and that's been the standard of care for over 2 decades, initially based on the landmark Gila trial. Some patients I'll use dose-adjusted EPOC-R, a more intensive regimen for. That's typically for certain subtypes like double-hit lymphoma, a particularly aggressive subtype of DLBCL with MYC and BCL2 translocations, or HIV-associated lymphomas and primary mediastinal large B-cell lymphoma. In the relapse refractory setting, which I know we're going to touch on a little bit more, we find that there's a whole host of different options, including chemotherapy, CAR T cell therapy, and a number of different targeted therapies, including antibody drug conjugates, antibody therapy, and different targeted therapies like BTK inhibitors, checkpoint inhibitors, and certain subtypes, and a drug called selinexor, which is a nuclear export inhibitor. I think that just emphasizes that there's a whole host of different therapies available. I will note, just as a point for listeners today, that their recent trial, the Polarix trial, is the first positive study in 2 decades in frontline DLBCL, where the substitution of polatuzumab vedotin, an antibody drug conjugate, for vincristine in the upfront setting showed an improvement in progression-free survival at 2 years. It's a modest benefit, 6.5% at 2 years, but there was no excess toxicity. And we await to see whether the FDA will approve what's called Pola-R-CHP as a potential alternative choice in the frontline setting, potentially in the next calendar year.
So you've mentioned that while many patients will respond to upfront therapies, there will be patients with refractory or relapsed disease. Could you elaborate about treatment strategies for these specific patients?
Relapse refractory DLBCL is another entity that's really undergone a significant amount of transformation in the treatment paradigm really over the last year. And that's because the historic paradigm for treatment of DLBCL has been when patients relapse, if they're fit for high-dose therapy, we would pursue salvage chemotherapy and an autologous stem cell transplant for those that are chemosensitive. CAR T-cell therapy has emerged in the last 5 years and has become the standard third-line therapy for patients who don't respond to second-line therapy. However, in the preceding year or so, we've now had 3 randomized controlled trials comparing CAR T-cells to salvage chemotherapy and a transplant. For all of these trials, patients had to either have primary refractory disease or relapse within 12 months of frontline therapy. 2 CAR T cells, axicell or axicabtagene ciloleucel and lysacell or lysacabtagene maraleucel, were significantly improved in respect to event-free survival compared to standard of care. And they're now FDA approved for this indication. Tisacell or tisagenlecleucel was a negative trial in the second line setting. So now my paradigm is when patients relapse, the first question I ask is, did they have primary refractory disease or relapse within 12 months? If so, axicell or lysacell is the new standard of care in the second line setting. If patients have a late relapse, so let's say they relapse 2 years after frontline therapy, salvage chemotherapy and a transplant is still the standard of care for those fit enough to receive that. If they're not fit enough for salvage chemotherapy and a transplant, lysacell specifically has a unique FDA approval for that setting. And so for an older adult who's not fit enough for a transplant but is fit enough for lysacell, that is a potentially curative option in the second line setting. For patients not fit for either, we would still use a personalized treatment to the patient, and we have a number of different targeted therapies we can pursue. Similarly, for those that relapse after CAR T-cell therapy, we have a number of different targeted therapies, antibodies and antibody drug conjugates, as well as other therapy options that we typically pursue.
Without going into too much depth, how would you manage patients with relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma and mantle cell lymphoma? Are the strategies similar to what you just mentioned for DLBCL?
That's another great question. They really are distinct. So for relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma, typically we'll actually ask, you know, what the pattern of relapse is and whether treatment is necessary. Once treatment becomes necessary, we have a number of different approaches in the relapse setting. Those can include chemoimmunotherapy, which depending upon what the patient received in the frontline setting can guide what chemoimmunotherapy we give. It can be CD20 therapy with rituximab or obinutuzumab alone, for patients who have sort of a low tumor burden. A useful strategy that I think many practitioners employ is to give lenalidomide, which is an immunomodulatory agent, which can be combined with either rituximab or obinutuzumab in the second line setting. Another option that's emerged recently is tazemetostat, which is an oral EZH2 inhibitor, particularly high response rates in EZH2 mutated patients. And on top of that, we have CAR T-cell therapies available for follicular in the relapsed refractory setting. For mantle cell lymphoma in the relapsed refractory setting, there are now multiple protein tyrosine kinase inhibitors that are approved, actually three. And so typically I use one of those three BTK inhibitors. Most notably, I tend to use zanubrutinib or acalabrutinib due to their favorable toxicity profile. For patients that have a contraindication to BTK, we have lenalidomide with rituximab as an option. And we actually now have CAR T cells also available in mantle cell with a product called brexucaptogene autoleucel, which has shown excellent response rates in highly relapsed refractory disease.
I'd like to get a little bit more into novel treatment strategies. I know you talked a lot about CAR T cell therapy. Can you elaborate a little bit on this?
Absolutely. So for follicular lymphoma, which we just briefly mentioned, we now have two CAR T cells that have FDA approval in the multiply relapsed refractory setting. Those include axi-cel and tisa-cel. Axi-cel actually has a response rate of over 90% and a complete response rate of nearly 80%. Tisa-cel has a response rate of about 86% and a complete response rate of nearly 70%. So both of these represent highly effective options for multiply relapsed patients. I'll note that axi-cel is a more toxic product than tisa-cel, and that's because it has a CD28 co-stimulation domain as opposed to a 4-1BB co-stimulation domain seen with tisa-cel. CD28 is associated with augmented cytokine release syndrome and neurologic toxicity risk. For mantle cell, as we briefly mentioned, brexucabtagene is the only product currently approved for mantle cell, but in multiply relapsed refractory patients, particularly those after relapsing after a BTK inhibitor, the response rate's over 90% with a complete response rate of 67% and a median progression-free survival of over 2 years. So these do represent highly effective therapies and are mostly reserved right now for the relapse refractory setting.
There are a lot of antibody therapies also available. Could you start with telling us a little more about antibody drug conjugates?
Absolutely. And antibody drug conjugates represent attractive treatment options in the relapsed refractory setting. We have three that are available in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Their names are polatuzumab vedotin, loncastuximab tesirine, and brentuximab vedotin. Brentuximab vedotin doesn't have FDA approval, but it's included in the NCCN guidelines and targets CD30. So I think it's probably more prudent to focus on polatuzumab and loncastuximab. Polatuzumab is the aforementioned antibody drug conjugate from the Polarix trial in the upfront setting, but it actually already has FDA approval in the relapsed refractory setting in combination with bendamustine and rituximab. It's actually based on a randomized phase 2 trial. It's given once every 21 days, up to 6 cycles, and it's associated with a response rate of 45%, a complete response rate of 40%, and a median progression-free survival of about 9.5 months, with a favorable toxicity profile, the most common toxicities being peripheral sensory neuropathy and cytopenias. The neuropathy occurs because the chemotherapy payload for polatuzumab is monomethyl auristatin E, which is a microtubule inhibitor, and the target for polatuzumab is actually CD79B. Loncastuximab is another antibody drug conjugate, has a different target, CD19, and a different chemotherapy payload, a pyrrolobenzodiazepine dimer, cytotoxin. It's given as a single infusion once every 3 weeks for up to a year. And in a large study of patients who mostly had DLBCL, but a small subset had double hit lymphoma, the response rate is just under 50%, with a complete response rate of just under 25%. The median duration of response with this therapy is just over 10 months, and the toxicity profile is also favorable. I'll note that there can be a specific GGT increase, which is not clinically relevant, and an edema, sort of capillary leak-like syndrome, which requires dexamethasone premedication with each dose.
We'll talk more about adverse events in our second podcast, but for now, let's talk a little bit about bispecific antibodies. Would you mind introducing us to the various agents in this class?
Absolutely. And I think you would agree with me that bispecific antibodies represent a novel treatment class that is an exciting set of therapies, and then these can potentially be added to the treatment armamentarium in the near future. In fact, one of these bispecifics has approval in Europe, mosunetuzumab. Bispecific antibodies, at least to date in relapsed refractory non-Hodgkin lymphoma, all target CD20 and CD3. There are four in late phase clinical development. Their names are epcoritamab, mosunetuzumab, glofitamab, and odronextamab. Glofitamab is a little bit unique in that it has two binding sites for CD20, but I think most notably, epcoritamab and mosunetuzumab can be administered subcutaneously, whereas glofitamab and odronextamab are exclusively administered intravenously.
I think that's all the time we have today. Thank you very much, Dr. Johnson. This has been very informative. I'm glad we could spend some time talking about NHL and all the various treatment strategies that are available for relapsed refractory NHL. I'd like to thank Dr. Johnson for taking the time to speak with us today. And thanks to all our listeners for joining us. Hopefully, you're able to tune in to some other podcasts in this series. There are a total of two, as well as some of the many other types of CME programs we offer. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our generous grant supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Have a great day.